This is Spectator Radio, the Spectator's curated podcast collection. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted to be joined by the author and broadcaster, Rachel Johnson. Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's jump straight in at the beginning with your childhood. What were mealtimes like when you were young?
Oh, they were very, very noisy. And we had most family holidays, and in Somerset, we have a family hill farm, and my father would sit at the head of the table and he would dominate proceedings by preventing conversation and instituting quizzes. Lunch was always something like Heinz tomato soup and bread and cheese. And supper, if we were lucky, was my grandmother's rice salad, which was a much longed-for treat, which was cooked Uncle Ben's rice, raw onion, raw tomato, and a can of tuna chucked in. Now, to us, this was an unhoped-for delicacy. Because my grandmother, as you might have gathered, was not noted for her cuisine or her abilities in the kitchen. In fact, she was born in Versailles, in a very smart bit of Versailles called the Pavillon du Barry, and she was waited on hand and foot kind of childhood, and then she married my grandfather, and was, she as she says, pitchforked into life as a Exmoor farmer's wife, and had never been taught how to cook, and didn't even put her own stockings on, so she could make about three things. And the other thing we liked that she made was what she called chocolate ice cream, which was a mixture of cocoa and carnation milk that she would put into ice, those metal ice trays. You're far too young to remember them, but she'd put them in metal ice. She'd whip up carnation milk and cocoa and freeze it, and that was ice cream. And we thought that was quite wonderful.
Was there anything you couldn't stand?
Well, I remember when Granny and Granddaddy had moved out of the farmhouse, which I've described, which was a classic Devon and Somerset longhouse, very primitive, where animals used to actually share the kitchen. And at lambing time, the baby lambs, was, if they were orphaned or sickly, would be actually put in the bottom of the Rayburn, which is a stove, or laid on sacking in front of it. But when they got older, they moved to the cottage. And I remember she asked us grandchildren if we would come and have supper in the cottage one evening. And we said yes, with slight trepidation, because you never knew what you were going to get. And we went over and there was this disgusting fug in the kitchen. And we all sort of felt, we sort of retched as we walked in. And we couldn't think what she was cooking. So we said, Granny, this smells delicious, etc. She said, what are we having? And she went over and she lifted the lid on this bubbling stock pot. And we children peered in, and all we could see was spikes and something boiling. And we thought it was a hedgehog. And we said, not a hedgehog. And she pretended it was a hedgehog. But it turned out to be tongue. And have you ever seen an ox tongue? Yeah. It's got those horrible kind of, I can't, excrescences on them, like spikes. And we couldn't eat it.
Was there an expectation that you would learn how to make the rice salad and the spiked tongue? Were you sort of at the stove side learning the secrets and tricks of the trade, or not?
Granny did teach me how to make apple crumble in 5 minutes flat, and I could still do it. I've done it to time.
It's a good skill.
You don't peel the apples. That's the trick. And you make sure the butter is at room temperature. But my mother taught me how to cook, because she's one of these instinctive cooks, and she never measures anything, and I equally never measure anything, which can go wrong when you're baking.
Yes.
So I do recommend listeners don't follow my example when it comes to baking, because you'll never make it in Celebrity Bake Off, which doubtless some of you will be invited to do.
And Rachel, you've got Turkish heritage as well. I mean, was that reflected in any of the food that you used to eat?
No, sadly not, because frankly, the Johnson lunch table would benefit from these, you know, the Turkish meze culture. But no, you know, we're pretty primitive beings. And when my father hosts, and he's a very gregarious and inclusive and expansive grandfather of 12/13 children. We have a bet before we go, which is it going to be sausages or pizza?
And what about school? Were there school dinners where you were? Do you have happy memories of them or really sort of vile memories?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I was always so hungry at school. I was sent to boarding school at age 10. And I just remember lying in bed in my dorm. I was one of only two girls at this boys' prep school. And just being so hungry, I would suck the toothpaste out of the tube because actually it dulls the hunger pangs. And being so hungry that I would look forward to breakfast. And then before breakfast happened, we would have to do drills in the open air, like military drills, or run to the end of the drive and back and do side down, clap downs. And then we'd run into breakfast. And I remember that things like a piece of really greasy fried bread with baked beans on top, tasting like the most delicious thing in the world, an eggy bread. Those school breakfasts were really good. And then those thin, really, really greasy sausages. But once I remember I was eating lunch in the school dining hall, which had these, one of those, it was in the school library and there were sort of honour boards. And I was eating shepherd's pie and I realised that as I was lifting the fork to my mouth, there was this juicy, wriggly maggot on my fork.
No.
And I remember being so horrified that I took my plate of shepherd's pie to the headmaster of Ashdown House, Forest Row, East Grinstead, Sussex. And I said, there are maggots in my shepherd's pie. And he went, oh, don't be ridiculous. Maggots are highly nutritious. And so he sent me away.
And you didn't eat it?
No, I didn't eat it.
I mean, I'm ready to declare that the worst school dinners we've heard of on the podcast.
Yeah, that's
so
definitely
far.
The worst so far. And then when you got to university, were things a bit better? You read classics at Oxford. I mean, were you part of any drinking societies, dining societies?
I used to go to, there was a sort of knocking shop. Now, that's the wrong expression, but you probably remember, some of you here. It was like, I can't think what is the right word for a sort of meat cattle market. But the biggest cattle market at Oxford when I was there, which was in the late 80s, was something called Chapsock. Does that ring any bells? The Cheese and Wine Appreciation Society. So Chapsock, basically you went and there was never any cheese, which was problematic for me because I love my cheese. And it was basically, you know, a cheap way of getting a lot of red wine down somebody you wanted to go to bed with, I assume. Apart from that, no, I'd occasionally eat at the Oxford Union at those sort of black tie pre-debate dinners. And, oh, I have got a good story.
Tell us.
Oh, I can't believe it's just popped into my mind. In my second or third year, I shared a house with Hugh Fernley Whittingstall, who has become a famous kind of nose-to-tail, roadkill-eating, Dorset-based chef. And I thought he would be a good person to live with because I knew he loved cooking. And in fact, I gave him his first cookery column, which was when I was editing ISIS in my second year. I gave him a sort of my life in food column at the back where he talked about food and how his mother had taught him how to make peppermint creams, and that started him off. Anyway, so I think I started Hugh off. And he would give these dinner parties, and there were upsides and downsides to living with Hugh. And the upsides were he gave dinner parties and he cooked. The downsides were he never, ever cleared up. And instead of washing up, I think what he did was he used to throw the dirty plates out of the window. That is true. And that was easier and more rational way of dealing with the mess than taking it into the kitchen. The other downside for living with Hugh was he brought from home a Kenwood mixer, which was unheard of heights of culinary sophistication for Oxford undergraduate digs. Problem was his Kenwood mixer was like a really powerful Nutribullet blender of nowadays, but it lacked a lid. So he would put his hand on the top and he'd press the button and go, you know, blitz the whatever he was blitzing, and sometimes forget that he didn't have a lid. And so the contents of the Kenwood would splatter like a Quentin Tarantino splatter movie all over the kitchen. And he didn't care. He didn't care about that either. Apart from that, Hugh, you were a perfect housemate.
And after Oxford, when you began earning a living and cooking for yourself and sort of running your own little household, what would you survive on?
I literally can't remember eating. In my 20s, I just don't think food was important. You know, like you hear what I'm saying?
No idea.
I mean, I was at the FT for most of my 20s, and then I had a spell at the BBC and 1 year in the Foreign Office. When I was at the Foreign Office, where I was for a year in something called policy planning stuff, I remember going to the ICA, which was in the Mall, to have, because they had these enormous salads. But I was also newly pregnant, and I remember the strain of eating, munching your way through these enormous salads would mean that I would come back to my office, so I had my own office, and lie down on a chaise longue that I had stolen from Linda Chalker's office. I still remember I was sitting in my office and I saw these kind of removal men moving this very handsome chaise longue past my open door, and I said, "Stop right there." And I said, and I opened the door wide and I said, "Bring it into my office," because I was pregnant and really, really tired all the time. So they did what I told them, and they put this chaise longue in my office, which meant I had a blissful year of my first pregnancy, basically asleep in an office in the Foreign Office. Yes, anyway.
And you also spent some time in DC. What was that like?
I did. When I had three small children, we moved to DC, where I was horrified by the state of American food. I remember taking them to Yellowstone National Park and trying to feed children in America. It's literally junk food wall to wall. White bread, corn syrup, fried everything. Everything's got a pound of butter and a pound of corn syrup. And yeah, it was shocking. You actually have to cook from at home. Mm. Otherwise you can't sort of eat healthily. I think it's got much better. Mm. But if you go to the West Coast as well, obviously New York and the West Coast are different because they are, you know, they're the home of sort of, what's the word? Not orthorexia, but, you know, everyone's skinny and everyone eats lots of greens. But in DC, you didn't have that. And yeah, I thought it was disgusting. Basically, American food is almost an oxymoron, like American cheese.
Do you enjoy cooking for your family, or is it born out of necessity?
A bit of both, to be honest. I'm not a very good cook, but I can do various things very quickly, and I've started making bread.
Oh, what kind of bread?
It's called five seed bread. And it's unbelievably heavy.
And
sometimes I give it to people as presents because I think, it's nice to give presents, homemade presents. And I hand it over and they kind of stagger under the weight. And they say, "Christ, what is this, a brick?"
When I first started cooking, I gave a friend of mine some lime marmalade. And as I slowly got better cooking, he later said to me, "Please don't ever give me lime marmalade again." So I learnt my lesson quickly.
And Rachel, you spent some time on a kibbutz as well in Israel. What was that like?
Wonderful for me, because I actually wrote a piece for The Spectator about the sexual hierarchy of the kibbutz.
The hummus and the eggs. And
you mentioned yogurt, hummus, forget the sexual hierarchy.
Sexual hierarchy of the kibbutz is really interesting, and I do refer you to my piece on it. Thank you, Fraser, for publishing it. One of my more curious omissions for you. I loved the kibbutz, and I loved the food on the kibbutz. It's so fresh. You know, it's all raw tomatoes and yogurt and, like, grilled chicken, and then it repeats. You know, and then you think, actually, after a while, you long for some disgusting American food.
Something deep fried.
Yeah.
And when you became editor of The Lady, I mean, did that involve lots of dining out? Were you entertaining a lot at that point?
The bliss of being editor of The Lady was the perks of office were I got my own office, which I could decorate, and I got two tea towels, freshly laundered tea towels every day, which I never understood why, as if I'd need to dry my dry myself off at regular intervals.
But with tea towels.
With these freshly laundered blue and white tea towels. It was also in the middle of Covent Garden. So lunch, I rediscovered the joy of lunch. I go to Terroir, which is a restaurant in just off Trafalgar Square, where I go to the Garrick quite often, and, you know, Oaxaca, or just wandering out into Covent Garden and Balthazar and all those places. So that was nice. And also the other perk of office was that as soon as you are editing a magazine, people send you stuff. And I cannot count how many simnel cakes I would get at Easter. So another simnel cake would arrive.
Do you like simnel cake?
No, I hate simnel cake.
Another quite heavy dish.
Yes, yeah. Alongside the five-seed bread.
And what about dinner parties? I mean, do you like hosting dinner parties? Do you go to a lot of dinner parties? I imagine you're quite busy.
I think I prefer hosting dinner parties to going to them, because if you're anything, if you're a controlling person, going to a dinner party is, let's face it, a nightmare. You go, you don't know who you're going to sit next to. You don't know what you're going to eat. You don't know what people are going to talk about. You know that somebody's going to say, what does Boris think about this? And it's a sort of 4-hour endurance test. I think if I were ruling the world, I would basically say that a dinner party should start at 8:30 and it should finish by 11. So there's this understanding that you can cut loose at 11. So there isn't a sense of, hostess dismay if people say calling an Uber. It's just a given, because that is long enough and you don't get drunk and it's a school night. And I think so, if that's what I would like to change about dinner parties, including my own. So people feel free that, it's that awful thing of like, you need to carry on drinking in order to sustain the dinner party. But, we're all too old to drink, to drink for 6 hours straight. Anyway, I do like hosting them though.
So if you're hosting, do you have a fail-safe, impressive dinner party dish? What do you cook?
I'm going to let you into such two really big trade secrets, okay? Okay, summer dinner, go to Cook, which is that other franchises are available. Buy the frozen coronation chicken. Thaw it. Then pretend you've made it by sprinkling the top with just like toasted slivered almonds, coriander, pine nuts. And then you, in little dishes, you do sides like mango chutney. People are knocked sideways by this, okay? And then you just make the rice.
Easy.
Okay, winter dinner. Trade secret. This is more expensive. Go to Lydgate's in Holland Park Avenue and get the chicken, ham and mushroom pie. This is the best thing you will ever put in your mouth. If you're vegetarian, you can get something else. And I promise you, you bring it out of the oven, like it's this enormous thing with like beautifully tooled pastry top, golden brown in an enormous earthenware dish, and you take it to the table and you see men's faces. You have like pulled every single man around that table as soon as you put the pie in front of them.
And dinner party chat, do you think Brexit has ruined dinner parties in the past few years?
Yes, I saw Simon Jenkins yesterday, who used to edit The Times and The Economist, and we were having a cup of tea and he said, I obviously raised the topic. And he sighed and said, my marriage has been saved by the fact that we have a rule, which is ABB after 7 o'clock. And I said, anything but Boris. I agree totally. He said, no, anything but Brexit. But I have heard of, have you heard of the strip Brexit evenings?
No.
Okay, apparently young people, I count anyone under 40, having strip Brexit dinners, whereby if anybody mentions Brexit, they have to take off an article of clothing.
Oh, wow.
Maybe we should have
weirdly,
one incentivised to talk about.
Weirdly, I haven't been invited to any of those.
You're obviously a Remainer and some of your family members are keen Brexiteers. I mean, hold on, Laura.
One of my family members is a keen Brexiter.
Don't slander the rest.
Sorry, no. What does that mean for family meal times? Do you play this? Presumably, you don't play this game at family meals.
Look, if I had a pound coin or a 50p Brexit coin for every time someone has asked me this, I could literally live off it. I think essentially, when alcohol is being taken, it's probably safer to avoid Brexit. And especially when my husband is present. So we have managed to get through two Christmases at Chevening, which is the residence of a foreign secretary. Really harmonious, happy Christmases en famille with 22 people in the house and just having the best time, dancing, mealtimes together, everything, going on walks, and not one single row.
I think that's pretty impressive without Brexit. Yeah. I mean, what are your secrets?
Exactly. So the secrets are just don't bring up the topic. If you do, I think what's better, if you have to talk about it, a walk is much better than a meal. Because with a walk, you can like say, change the subject and you don't have to make eye contact because you're walking side by side. But anyway, so I commend that example of having a divided household politically, but emotionally you can still get on and love each other and like each other despite profound political differences.
I mean, this is a food podcast. We have to ask, are you stockpiling for Brexit?
And if so, what?
Oh, God, that's a really good question. No, not yet. The thing is, I've got a cupboard, one of those like larder cupboards, and it's so full anyway. I'm quite looking
would you
forward
like
to a no deal.
Some lime marmalade?
Yes, I need that. I'm quite looking forward to a no deal Brexit, so I can just eat through all the chutney that my brother, older brother, makes every year and gives as cute presents to people in Kilner jars. That are about 2 litres. I've got so many litres of apple chutney in my larder.
And when you do need to shop, where do you, you wrote a piece for The Spec actually recently about Waitrose and wondering what had happened to it recently. I mean, do you shop at Waitrose still?
I do. I secretly also shop at Marks and Spencer. I'm a sucker for those packets of like grains with kale and wheat berries and this and that, because I think it's kind of going to do me good rather than eating just plain rice. So I eat a lot of those.
It's like a grown-up rice salad.
Exactly. I'm harking back.
You're harking back to childhood.
To those childhood memories, that Proustian Madeleine.
You're conditioned.
You've actually got a rice story here that you were in Greece and there was a family rice. You ended up cooking stuff that you found behind a bin.
Oh,
is that?
Yes. Dumpster rice.
Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I will tell you about that. I can't remember where I wrote that. I took my three kids and one of Boris's kids, Milo, to Greece. And we arrived, it was like one of those really, really early flights. So when we arrived, it was sort of lunchtime, late lunchtime. We flew to Volos. And there's a supermarket between Volos and Pelion that I wanted to stop at and like buy everything. And we got to the supermarket. For some reason, it was closed. I couldn't think why, but so in despair, we were in the car park, and then I suddenly noticed that there was a wheelie bin. We'd all got out, and we were sitting on this wall next to this wheelie bin, and I don't think I looked in the wheelie bin, but somebody looked in the wheelie bin, and lo, what we found in the wheelie bin were packets. Unopened packets of food. What did we do? We took them and we ate them.
You're a freegan.
What's wrong with it?
It sounds very economically sensible to me.
Sometimes, I'm making rice. Milo says nothing will be as good as the dumpster rice.
What was in the dumpster rice? What made it so special?
I think it was a sort of one of those slightly flavoured rice. It had like flecks of chilli and olive oil and it was just so good.
And what about holidays? I mean, when you go on holiday, do you like to cook? Or if you're sharing a villa with people, does that ever get tricky?
That's a nightmare. I think if you're sharing a villa with people or you're in a villa, this is my rule. And forgive me if this sounds really, really first world, because I know that not everyone will be able to afford this. I have a sort of secret theory that eating out and eating in work out the same in terms of cost, emotional cost and financial cost. The emotional cost of eating in is high and the financial cost is low. But when you go out, the emotional cost is low and the financial cost is high. So you've got to work out sort of way of working through these, the balance of it. And so what I do is I say we're going to have one meal out and one meal in a day. Sometimes we don't achieve that. Sometimes we have two meals out or we have two meals in. But essentially, I don't think you should feel guilty about not schlepping to the local market and sniffing the melons and then coming, schlepping them home. You're on holiday, right? You've got to roll in eating out as part of the overall cost. And just think of the, and you know, you won't remember all those times, you know, you ate in and saved 40 euros.
And the emotional harmony. Tell us about Celebrity Big Brother, because there was food involved in your time on there, wasn't there?
The viewers didn't see this, but they divided the house into girls' teams and boys' teams, and the girls' team had to do all the cooking and food prep for a whole week. And guess who had to do it? Me. And they thought it would be funny, and indeed it was for the viewer, but not for the cook, that they would let the boys' team do the supermarket shop for the girls team without asking the girls team what we wanted. So we had absolutely no control, and yet we had to cook and prepare the food that the boys had gone to the Tesco in Elstree or whatever. And so when the boys' shop arrived, I was unpacking it, and like these enormous bags and bags of white Mother's Pride crisps, sausages, a couple of packets of tomatoes, and then like enormous packet after packet of mild cheddar, and then lots and lots of pasta. So I was going through the shop, and then I stormed out of the larder, and I said, I called the boys over and I said, where's the Parmesan? Like that. And the boys had just said, what do you mean Parmesan? And I said, how do you expect me to make pasta without Parmesan? And apparently this turned into a sort of, you know, Rachel's middle class nightmare. Parmesan was trending on Twitter. I completely lost it. Anyway, so when it came to nominations, all the boys were like, Rachel was really moody and she was really ungracious when we got mild cheddar instead of Parmesan. So I'm nominating Rachel for eviction, so, which was great because my game plan was to get in, get out as fast as I could of the Big Brother house. And so I was the second eviction. And that, thanks to my strop out over the fact that the boys didn't bring me Parmesan.
Mild cheddar. Why does anyone buy mild cheddar? That's
what is the point of mild cheddar anyway? If you're going to have cheddar.
Thank you so much, Rachel. And we've got a special offer, which actually I'll let you.
Oh, well, allow me to plug Waitrose again. If you subscribe to spectator.co.uk/voucher, you will get a £20 voucher to spend at Waitrose or John Lewis Partnership. So that's a deal.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. Comme nos destins sont différents.